Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. We are spending this entire week talking about the Santa Fe Film Festival. We're going to be interviewing many actors and writers and directors, and right now we have with us John Bowman. He's the executive director of the Santa Fe Film Festival, and Stephen Rubin, the program director. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks, Charlotte.
Great to have you. So let's talk about this film festival. John Bowman, how old is the Santa Fe Film Festival, and where does it stand now in terms of film festivals all around the United States?
We're in our ninth season, although if you look back in time, we actually in some ways are in our 11th season because we had two ad hoc festivals that we ran for a couple years under different names in the same time slot. So, but technically we're 9 years under our official name, Santa Fe Film Festival, and that's pretty long period of time for festivals. They come and they go, tend to, so we're starting to kind of pull out from the pack and establish an identity.
And what is that identity? I mean, obviously, we're not Sundance. Nobody's Sundance but Sundance itself. But, you know, what is the Santa Fe Film Festival? How are we seen in the country?
Well, I think that we're starting to be seen as at least a major regional festival and a festival that is among the major regional festivals, a festival where there is a bit of an international flavor owing to Santa Fe and the audiences here and the sophistication of the viewers. And so a number of overseas distributors are looking toward us to unveil certain titles that maybe they haven't unveiled on either coast, and that may be special and different and need that kind of a platform that we can offer.
I think we are growing into much more of a national, international, and destination festival. We have about 90% of the accepted filmmakers attending, which is really a great rate because we're not at that level where we're able to bring them. We are, thanks to the support from the hospitality industry in Santa Fe, we do have ways to provide lodging for people. So that's people deciding that from their limited budget that they want to make sure they come to this festival and interact with our audiences. So it's really an exciting growth, I think.
Stephen, you are the program director. Let's talk about programming. It's a pretty competitive festival. If you send a film in, chances are not great that you'll be accepted. You have, what, a 10 or 12% acceptance rate?
That's right, yeah. I mean, we you know, for the five categories that we take films from the submissions, you know, we have about 13 programs in each of those. And so it's a pretty, you know, we joke with people that your child has a better chance of getting into Yale or Harvard than getting into the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Well, gee. And what is the process like by which you choose the films?
We have a panel of wonderful film screeners that are people in the community that are film background or just film aficionados. And they watch the films and then they make recommendations that I watch and share with John, so we make the final decisions based on, you know, sometimes 40 people. You know, we try to have each submission watched by at least three different people. So
what are all the different categories of films? You've got documentaries, you've got Southwestern films, you've got narrative films.
Yeah, John created years ago these nifty little titles. So we have the Independent Spirits, which is American films that are, you know, independently financed. We have the Making It Real category, which is documentaries. Eye on the World are international films, which, as John mentioned, really is growing in submissions and what we're showing. And then John created a great series, very appropriate for Santa Fe, called Art Matters, which are films that pertain to the creative spirit of visual art, theater, music, anything like that. And that category has actually been mimicked by a lot of other festivals. And then we have the Southwest Showcase, which is showcasing any genre of film from the region.
John Bowman, when you look at New Mexico's burgeoning film industry, as we like to call it, how has it progressed in the last few years, and how has that affected the Santa Fe Film Festival?
Well, there's no doubt that having that industry around us has helped us in enormous ways to not only acquire a better reputation, but more sponsors and patronage and interest level among viewers. I mean, in the beginning, a lot of the viewers were vicariously experiencing film through our festival. Now a lot of the viewers are actually participating in the industry, and so for them this is almost an occupational hazard.
Do you have any, I wanted to ask the two of you, do you have any favorite films of the festival so far?
Well, there are an enormous number of the films that I'm partial to, but some of the ones that I like in particular that fall in that orphan film category, and by that I mean films that the audiences may not pick up on initially because they're smaller and maybe not as well known. They don't have any stars or big budget, whatnot. But one of the titles in that category, and I think a particular relevance for Santa Fe, is called Under Our Skin. It's a picture about the Lyme tick disease, mostly in the American Southwest, but it really touches on that whole subject of environmental hazards and ability of people to shield themselves and protect their themselves from disease and infestations, and it's done in a way that it's almost like the television show House. It's really a medical thriller as much as it is a documentary.
We carefully choose the films, you know, so we have a reason why everything, whether it's higher profile or, as John mentioned, the ones that that, you know, maybe a little more obscure, but we feel have a good chance. And two of those that are a narrative called Jackson, which is there's this funny scene where all these homeless folks break out into song, and it's really it's a neat movie. And then
not only song, it's operatic song.
Yeah. And then programming wise, there's a new addition. We've had the New York Jewish Film Festival and the National Geographic All Roads, and this year we have the American Film Institute with their Project 2020, which is bringing three films and filmmakers that are films from looking at through the lens at other cultures. So Kasim the Dream is an uplifting sports movie about a boxer, and then Of All the Things is an American documentary about Dennis Lambert, who wrote, among other songs, Rhinestone Cowboy, and he kind of drifted into obscurity, and then he's become a big star in
The Philippines.
Yeah.
Of all places.
Of All the Things.
of All the Things is the name of the film.
And the third AFI 2020 film is Iron Ladies of Liberia, which is about the first woman to become president of any country in Africa. And all three of those filmmakers will be here on one of our panels, so it's really an exciting addition to it.
I have to say, I've only screened maybe a half a dozen of the films so far. I'm going to be talking to filmmakers all week. But my favorite so far is a narrative film called 222, yeah, which is just a heist movie. I don't even like crime movies normally, but it's fabulous. It's so well edited, and all the characters are really interesting. So that's one of my picks so far.
Yeah, that's a very good one. And you know, it does have a cameo by Val Kilmer, who might hopefully have a cameo in person at the festival.
Yeah, he definitely has a small but very twisted, interesting role in that film, 222. Let's talk about the panels. In addition to billions and billions of films that nobody, unless they just had coffee intravenously injected into their veins at all times, could see all of them or even half of them. But in addition to the gazillion films, you've got some other activities going on.
Yeah, we have 10 different panels and workshops, most of which take place at Warehouse 21, one of our new partners. And so we have industry people coming in, the filmmakers participating, and also support from wonderful of our residents. So there's a panel on acting, the art, and passion, which has Alan Arkin on it, and then one of our guests, Giancarlo Esposito, who is a recognizable face from a lot of Spike Lee films and The Usual Suspects, and he'll be here because his first film, Gospel Hill, is first time directing, producing, and starring in. It also has Danny Glover and Samuel Jackson and Angela Bassett. It's a beautiful movie.
And the name of that movie again?
Gospel Hill.
Right.
And there's one of our tributees is the actor James Cromwell, who is in a film that we're showing called A Lonely Place for Dying, a New Mexico-made feature having its world premiere. So James Cromwell will be on that panel. We have the art and business of screenwriting, and our fabulous Santa Fe resident Kirk Ellis is on that panel. And
who wrote John Adams, John which Adams. We've talked about on this show, an amazing HBO multi-part miniseries.
Yeah, and then there's two other screenwriters have been added to that panel. One just moved here who wrote Apollo 13 and did some other films with that have Tom Hanks. And then another colleague of Kirk Ellis who moved here recently will be on that panel. So it's going to be...
And are those well attended?
Yeah, they have been in the past, and I feel like this year that there'll be more people there. They're kind of a bit more higher profile with not only the New Mexicans that I mentioned, but people from the industry. You know, there's Oscar-winning producers and major VPs of acquisitions from companies. So for those interested in about how you market and franchise a film, there's panels on that. There's an animation panel. There's a panel on film composing. And what's exciting about our three tributaries this year is that they're going to be here most of, or all of the time and really be integrated. So Howard Shore, the Oscar-winning composer of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, who did a lot of work with Cronenberg and Martin Scorsese, he's on that soundtrack film composing panel also. So
tributees, every year you basically give awards to people who have done something amazing, or really had a lifetime in film in one way or another.
Yes, and this year, you know, we mentioned James Cromwell, and we're showing L.A. Confidential, as well as the New Mexico film he's in. And for Howard Shore, we have three titles. One is the director's cut of Return of the King, and then we're showing two of his new films. One is Doubt, based on the high-profile play that has Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman. And we're also showing a new film of his called Betrayal, and the director of that, Tavi, will be here as well.
I'm glad you're showing Doubt. That is a play that was actually performed here in Santa Fe as a play, local theater, and it's a marvelous play. And then with the actors Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it can't help but be fabulous.
It's a great movie.
Yeah,
and
we do have a third tributee, Vilmos Zsigmond, who I'm real excited to have come because he shot probably the most beloved Santa Fe film of all time, Red Sky at Morning. He's a cinematographer. Also did Hired Hand here with Peter Fonda. Then probably better known for Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Deliverance and Deer Hunter.
Now, we're having an economic downturn, which is affecting all of society in one way or another. John Bowman, how's it affecting the film industry?
Well, you know, they always say the film industry is recession-proof, but I'm not so sure that that's always the case. So far, the industry has definitely battened down the hatches a little bit more, and I noticed some of the studios announced they weren't going to have holiday parties, that sort of thing. But in terms of production, it seems so far that the number of films green-lighted and up for being created the next year isn't going to be affected. The only thing that could affect the industry more would be an actor strike.
Yeah, there's definitely an impact. You know, a lot of people are reporting from studios that a lot of workers are getting laid off, you know, it's definitely even harder than it already was as a producer to get your film greenlit. Although, as John said, there is a sense that it's recession-proof. Really, what it is that people will always want to go to movies. So
people always want to go to movies, but there are independent movies, there are mainstream movies. How is the economic climate affecting independent movies?
I think much more severely. It's a lot harder for an independent to get made.
I mean, it's an interesting moment because, of course, we have the independent film industry has gotten a lot stronger because it's so affordable for people to make movies in a way that it wasn't even, you know, 5, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, definitely the means of production are at people's hands much more than they were in the past. What hasn't changed so much has been the distribution channels, and that's really why festivals have flourished, to kind of fill that gap and make titles available that are being made and produced but aren't necessarily getting distributed through the normal means.
It's always tough for anyone, whether you've got $30 million or $30,000 to make a movie, but the upside of that is that with the increased technology, that things always, you know, there's a new camera coming out, not to mention post-production equipment every week, so it's a lot easier more affordable to get a really high quality look. So while it still takes a lot of money, you can make a $1 million looking picture for $100,000, $200,000 if you're smart about it. So.
Now, is anybody still using film, and do you project film at the film festival?
You know, we still do project film, but it's down to maybe only 20% of the titles. Maybe 80% of the titles are on digital format in some shape or another, and it's the exact opposite of when we started the festival 9 years ago, when probably 75-80% of the films were on film stock and only a handful were on digital forms.
The definite trend is towards digital, and I think most people feel like there isn't much of a reason. Film purists wouldn't agree to shoot on film, because if you got even $3 or $5 or $10 million budget, you could still do a lot more with it if you shoot on digital. And because, you know, with the new RED camera, whatever will be out next year, you can make things that look, it's still has a different look, but the quality is accepted. I think a lot of audiences don't realize sometimes with mainstream films or even independent films that they're watching something that was shot digitally. It's definitely got its own look to it, that there are certain films that really wouldn't even look the same on 35 anymore, the way digital is.
Now, Stephen Rubin, you are not only with the Santa Fe Film Festival as a program director putting it all together, you're working at the Santa Fe Film Center, which goes all year round, but you're also a filmmaker yourself. Are you up to any tricks these days?
I'm hoping once I get a little sleep after the festival that I'll be able to dive into some creative work, whether it's as an actor or director or producer. I do have a small part in one of our films this year, so that's
my, really? Which one?
I'm in Lonely Place for Dying, the film that has James Cromwell, and if you want to see me not live through a movie, this is your chance.
Oh, dear. Tell us about the Santa Fe Film Center.
The Film Center is our year-round venue, and particularly right after the festival, we really get to showcase the festival films. It's an opportunity for, as Mary Charlotte mentioned, you know, how can anyone see all the 250 films during the festival?
So is it 250?
Shorts and features.
That's including the shorts, some of which are 3 minutes long.
Yeah. So, at the Film Center, it's a chance for the filmmakers to get that theatrical screening, and it's a chance for the local audiences to see a lot what's in the festival. So it is nice to have that, for sure.
So the Film Center is in it was formerly known, as some people might remember, as the Cinema Cafe, and is a venue that will be very active during the Santa Fe Film Festival. And it has couches, so people can actually sit on comfortable couches and watch films from there. The Santa Fe Film Festival runs from Wednesday, December 3rd, through December 7th, which is a Sunday.
That's right.
People coming from all over the place, all over the world, both to attend and to show to participate.
Yeah, we have, you know, a lot of the filmmakers I mentioned. Also, what's exciting this year with the panels is that there are a lot of people coming from, you know, the industry, from LA, Chicago, New York, and they're also, we have a different kind of jurying process this year. So there's three jurors for each of the 13 juried awards, and those people are a mix of New Mexico film aficionados and film industry, as well as people coming from the outside of the state.
So. Another thing to emphasize for your listening audience is that on our website this year, a lot of the filmmakers have posted their trailers, and so even though these films may be real obscure and you may not have heard of them before, you can get on the website and take a look at the trailers and get a good sense of what they're about.
The website is much stronger than it has been, and that's thanks to one of our new partners, B-Side, and they're hosting the film's schedule, so you can see the trailers, as John said, which are also hosted on several other of our new partners. There's all these new websites that are offering alternative distribution for filmmakers, so that's something exciting, and that growth is affecting our festival and the opportunities for patrons and filmmakers.
So you're doing educational partnerships with various institutions?
Yeah, we have locally a much stronger direct partnership with the College of Santa Fe and Warehouse 21, as well as the Santa Fe Community College, and IATSE, the union, is helping, and so is the New Mexico Film Museum and the New Mexico Film Office to make these panels really strong, and we want to carry that on starting next year so that, you know, at least once a month there's a forum for filmmakers to show their works, and hopefully we can bribe some of the people with the big films to maybe do some talks and panels during the year too.
John Bowman, anything else you would like people to know about the Santa Fe Film Festival?
I think like for people not to be too daunted by the scope and size of it, and just to realize that there is no way, as you mentioned, for everyone to see everything. And so to kind of pick their poison and focus on a few titles and realize that what they missed, they can catch through the course of the year at the Film Center or at the screener or some of our other partners.
Stephen Rubin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you pick your films, and then some people really, some people are just interested in the films, but others are interested some are interested just in the social events and panels, and a lot of people probably do a mix, but, you know, there's really a wide option on top of the films with all the panels and all the social events for people to share their love of film, whether you're a filmmaker or just someone who watches 10 movies a day like John and I. There's something for everyone. So.
Now, the Santa Fe Film Festival is on the web at santafefilmfestival.com, and these newsprint flyers that have the whole entire film festival with a description of each and every piece can be found all over the place.
All over town. They were distributed by Pasatiempo. They're at coffee shops and theaters. And also this week our nice new catalogs arrived. So if you come by our box office across from the Hotel Santa Fe, you can grab one of our catalogs that has longer descriptions and all the information.
By the way, I will have to also say Benicio del Toro is a kind of favorite actor of mine, and he's made of two-part, gigantically long Che Guevara film, Che the Argentine and Che Guerrilla. They're both 2 hours long. They're screening at the Screen on Wednesday and Thursday at 6 in the evening. That's a big event as well.
That's a phenomenal film, and we actually had to get Steven Soderbergh, the director's, permission to do it on two nights. We felt that that was the best way to get everyone to see this wonderful film. It really is two strong parts. The first part is Benicio del Toro as Che before he left Argentina, and then the second part is when he became the legendary revolutionary. So,
John Bowman is executive director of the Santa Fe Film Festival, and Stephen Rubin is program director. The Santa Fe Film Festival runs Wednesday through Sunday, December 3rd through 7th. They're on the web, santafefilmfestival.com. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, as always, Mary Charlotte, and we'll see everyone at the festival.
We'll see you at a million and one movies.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Shane McDougall. He is the director of the documentary Wiener Takes All, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival on Thursday, December 4th at 2 o'clock and Saturday, December 6th at 4:30 at the DeVargas 3 Theater. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, this is a hilarious movie. I have to say I'm partial to it being a Dachshund owner, but how did you find yourself making a documentary about Dachshund racing?
It's kind of strange. About 4 years ago, I was desperately looking for a topic to shoot a documentary short about. And I wanted something that was kind of unusual and offbeat, and I really couldn't find anything. And then one afternoon, I was sitting on my couch, and along came this news story that showed the Wiener Nationals, which is one of the regional races, at Los Alamitos in California. And they had something like 14,000 people packing the stadium for the Wiener Dog races. And it was one of those moments of clarity where you go, okay, that's my topic. It's going to be called Wiener Takes All. It'll be a year in the life of. And 3 years later, what started out as an intended 20-minute short ended up being an hour and 20-minute long feature.
So you followed it for more than a year.
Oh, yeah. It was about 3 years. We followed the different circuits. And it wasn't just Wiener Dog racing. We did, you know, the Show Dog circuit. We did Earth Dog, but mostly Wiener Dog racing. But yeah, it was 3 years of going across the country.
It seems to me, now correct me if I'm wrong, that these dogs were just not bred to race.
Well, they're not bred to race. They were originally bred to hunt underground. A lot of people, there's actually kind of a controversy about the racing that I actually took out of the film. But the Dachshund Club of America is actually quite opposed to Dachshund racing, and they've actually given me quite a bit of grief over the film, over the past few years, because they're afraid that these dogs, you know, they're long, long spines, short legs, obviously not built for racing. But actually, when you see them run, I mean, they're really fast dogs.
Well, they are strangely fast dogs when they decide that they really want to run at all, which is
true.
In any given race, some of them don't even want to go out of the starting gate.
Yeah, well, that's the key. I mean, you get to some of the qualifying races, and some of these dogs that have never raced before, the door opens and they tumble out and sniff the dogs, but, you know, sit next to them. The dogs that really train, I mean, the champion dogs, the ones that go on to win the nationals and are kind of the regional champions, they know how to race. But their owners inevitably do off-season training with them, you know? I mean, just getting a dog out of the gate, especially a wiener dog, short attention spans and all, you really kind of have to practice that. If they can master going from one end to the other, yeah, there's no stopping a fast wiener dog, but yeah, like you say, the biggest challenge is getting them out of the gate.
Now, the owners seem pretty fanatical, and a lot of the film is interviews with dog owners, and it gets surreal at moments, but what's in it for them? Is there good money to be made in this dachshund racing business?
Define good money. The typical purse is like, you know, $1,000 or $2,000. If you win the nationals, I think it might be $5,000. You're certainly not talking six figures. Now, in the show dog portion, the show dog wiener dog world, that's different. Then you're talking five-figure to six-figure sums. And of course, if you get, you know, if a wiener dog were to win something like Westminster, then you're talking, you know, million-dollar endorsements and that sort of stuff. So in the show dog world, there's definitely money to be made. In the wiener dog world, racing world, not so much. It's definitely out of passion and competitiveness.
How did dachshund racing originate in the first place?
That's a good question. I mean, we were able to find references to it back into the 1930s, but it really kind of was sort of more of like an agility test for the dachshund clubs, you know, to show how, you know, they would go through these different things, obedience, obstacle courses, that sort of thing. And one of them would be speed and agility. So they'd have these mini races. Then in the early 90s, Miller Lite hired an advertising agency, and they came up with these campaigns that were mixing basically ideas that wouldn't normally mix together. One of them was dog shows and drag racing. So they did this commercial that basically was the Miller Lite Wiener Nationals, and that ad went on to become one of the biggest, most successful hits in American television history. It really turned the whole campaign around. Miller Lite, up until they'd done this campaign, had been losing, hemorrhaging money and market share. Within basically a couple of weeks of the Wiener Dog ad coming out, the slide had stopped, and they were actually starting to Miller Lite was starting to gain market share again. Stranger yet, though, was within a couple months of this commercial going on the air, wiener dog races, commercial large-scale wiener dog races, started popping up all across the country. And now, you know, over, you know, 10, 12 years later, we have 75-plus wiener dog races.
I shudder to think what that means about American society.
No comment.
We're talking to Shane McDougall about the documentary Wiener Takes All, which is here at the Santa Fe Film Festival. So once you've made this movie, I mean, you say that people who are opposed to dachshund racing have given you a hard time. I mean, is this a movie? Having watched the whole thing, and I watched parts of it a couple of times because they're just so amusing, I don't know whether you could say that this is a pro dachshund movie, dachshund racing movie, or anti.
Well, and that was kind of the approach I wanted to take. Initially when I went into this, I was so naive, and I thought everybody would want to be on board because it promotes the breed and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, the whole Dachshund Club of America's stand on it, and it's, I understand what their take is, because if you look, you know, a lot of the greyhound tracks across the country, inevitably their top attended event every year is the wiener dog race. And these greyhound tracks are running wiener dog races to get people into the tracks so that they can get them basically hooked on the greyhound racing. But, you know, if you look at their attendance numbers on a regular night, they'll get, you know, maybe a couple hundred. And then they have the wiener dog races, and they're
at the thousands. That's weird beyond belief.
Well, it is very odd. I mean, I really did want to take a very neutral position. Although, as you'll see through the film, I kind of did get attached to the dogs, so I was always rooting for them to win. So my, you know, some of my independence was gone. But I really didn't want to take a side as to whether or not I was for or against the racing. To be honest, I mean, the Dachshund Club of America, they're afraid that it's going to become commercialized, like the Greyhounds. And that,
right.
You know, a losing greyhound gets put down. And, you know, there are hundreds to thousands that get put down every year, which is a segment, actually, that I took out. We had some detectives go to some vet clinics in the South, and we videotaped hundreds of dogs being disposed of in the dumpster, greyhounds that had, had a losing series. Of course, that kind of didn't exactly fit into the happy-go-lucky winner-takes-all that exists now. So we eventually cut it out just because of, you know, the outcry of the you know, people that went in expecting to see a fun, happy documentary, and then all of a sudden it ground to a screeching, dog-killing halt. My take on it, though, is I really don't think you would see dachshund racing commercialized. These dogs at race are inevitably family pets. They're loved. They're a member of the household. They're not a financial investment like greyhounds are. That said, and I can see the Dachshund Club of America's point, you know, you have these racetracks that, you know, you look at the numbers, they get a couple hundred people on a regular night, you know, then they have the wiener dog races, they have several thousand. I can easily see how something like that could get commercialized. And the reality is, we did talk to some people who were talking about setting up professional circuits across the country as money-making ventures. So there is that very remote possibility it could be commercialized. I mean, I can see many other stranger things happening before that, but I don't see it as a risk.
Well, when the champions have names like Noodles and Pretzel, you do think, I don't know, one thinks there must be a limit to how seriously people can take it.
Well, Noodles Pretzel, I mean, that was a very, very hotly fought rivalry. I mean, the Noodles and Pretzel, and I guess you look at some of the other Baby Love, of course, and you know, a lot of the perennials. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to take them, hard to think of a champion with the name of Noodles, for sure, but you get him out there and he's strutting his stuff and you understand why he is the champion.
Shane McDougall is the director of the documentary Wiener Takes All. You can find more about it on the internet at wienertakesall.com. And you can, I think they're adding, it's been so popular already in terms of ticket sales. I think it might be sold out or near sold out already, but I think they're going to add another screening. But the screenings that I know about so far are Thursday, December 4th at 2 o'clock and Saturday, December 6th at 4:30 at the DeVargas 3 Theater. And you can check santafefilmfestival.com for more information. Oh, we just got breaking news right now. The extra screening of Wiener Takes All is on Sunday at 4:15 at the Santa Fe Film Center. Shane McDougall, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Craig Causen. He is the grandson of Chuck Jones, and we're here to talk about the film that is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival, Chuck Jones, Memories of Childhood. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So how did this film come to be made? It's a beautiful 25-minute film, and it's one of the last interviews with your grandfather, Chuck Jones, who was the originator of the Looney Tunes cartoons that we all probably know and love very much.
Yeah, you know, there was a woman, Peggy Stern, a wonderful friend of the family, who decided back in the late 90s that she wanted to produce a series on the sources of creativity. And Chuck Jones was the first person that she decided was going to be the target of her series. And so she did the actual interviews over 10 years ago, which was the last few years of his life. And it was, her questions were unique in that they were very different from, everybody wanted to know about history, and she was really captivated about how it is that he developed his creativity. So she went out and spent a number of days with him in his studio at his house in Southern California and asked him questions about his childhood and about how he developed his creativity, how it, where it came from, and this many years later finally came to the screen this year through support from Warner Brothers and from Turner Classic Movies to bring it to the screen, and it's just been a passion of hers, Peggy's, for years and years, and now it's finally come to fruition.
It's a lovely film because it's he speaks about, Chuck Jones speaks about his childhood and things that are so simple, like the arrival of a stray cat. And the way he talks about it, the arrival of this stray cat becomes not just a cat shows up, but it's a whole character with who becomes fascinating, but only fascinating in the eyes of somebody who is as creative as he was.
It is very true. And Johnson, who was the cat that that showed up when he was a young child on the beaches of Manhattan Beach, and had a funny tongue depressor around his neck that happened to have the name Johnson on it. And my great uncle confirmed that this was actually true. I think most people would think here's a character that was created by my grandfather, but in actuality, yes, there was a cat named Johnson, and of course. I think it was probably preordained that Chuck would come in contact with a cat like this because it was a very peculiar cat in that it loved to eat grapefruit, it loved to swim in the ocean, and it wanted nothing to do, for the most part, to be an ordinary cat. So those types of things are the incidences throughout his life that helped carve out his place in the creative world.
Now, that example with the cat Johnson and many others are illustrated in the film through a series of animations that are, I guess, not by Chuck Jones, but very much in his spirit. How did those come to be?
Well, a wonderful friend of Chuck's and Academy Award-winning animation director, John Canemaker, who's the head of the animation department at NYU, got together with Peggy. They had won the Academy Award 2 years ago for Moon and the Sun, and collaborated on this. And so in Chuck's style, they took Chuck's original drawings that he drew during the interview process and brought them to life. And they're done in the style of John Canemaker, which is very rustic, very artistically done. They didn't want to bring anything new to the film other than what Chuck was talking about. And so John was very careful to take Chuck's original sketches and keep them, just illustrate what Chuck was talking about. So they're beautiful renditions of sequences that would never otherwise have been animated, like Johnson and like the orchestration of the waves and wonderful snippets of animation that were created for the film.
What was it like for you growing up as his grandson? It seems from just this interview that Chuck Jones had such a wonderful, eternally childlike spirit.
I think that definitely anybody who came in contact with Chuck during his lifetime, and even those that didn't come in contact with him, that came in contact or have come in contact with his works, all the cartoons that he created over 300 films during his lifetime, and they're shown in nearly 200 countries throughout the world. Get the understanding that Chuck was a unique spirit, different from anybody else that they'd ever meet. Certainly he was the most well-read, articulate, genius of a man that I have ever met, and I have been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with him. And growing up with him was just was never predictable. He had an incredible sense of humor. He never took himself seriously. He said, always take your work seriously, but never take yourself seriously. And he lived that. And the greatest memories that I have to do with when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, learning how to swim. And Chuck was the type of grandfather that he came into the area of the pool where I had learned to swim, and I was dog paddling in the middle of the pool. And without a hitch, he was fully clothed, including a sort of a sailor's type of hat that protected his face, and fully clothed, ran off the end of the diving board and swooped me up into his arms after being underwater, tossing me in the air with a big woo-hoo. And that was the type of guy that Chuck was. There was nothing predictable about him, and he just decided that he was going to live life to the fullest every single day, which included reading and drawing and writing, and he did all those things every day of his life.
Craig Cawson is the grandson of Chuck Jones. The film is Chuck Jones: Memories of Childhood, and it screens on Thursday, December 4th at 7 o'clock with the film Wild Blue Yonder at the DeVargas 3, and also on Saturday, December 6th at 2 o'clock as well in the same location. Craig Cawson, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to introduce Jeannie McGill. She is the originator and co-producer of the documentary Milking the Rhino, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival on Thursday, the 4th of December at 11:30 and Saturday, the 6th of December at 7 o'clock at the DeVargas 3 Theater. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, you are a Santa Fe resident, and it's been so interesting to see this film go through the long process of being made. You were on the show, I think, maybe a couple of years ago.
I think it was about 2.5.
And so this is a film about it's the relationships between rural African communities and the endangered wild animals among whom they live and the land on which they're living. How did and it takes place in two different countries
yes.
in Africa. How did you come across this whole story?
Well, my background is as a safari operator in Kenya. I did educational safaris. So I was aware of community-based conservation. And it's a very long story within itself how this whole thing came about. But I approached David Simpson, who is the director, editor, co-producer, writer of Milking the Rhino, and said to him, how would you like to do a documentary film on community-based conservation in Africa? And he said, what's that? And in the process of explaining that to him, he was very interested, and he said, well, we'll have to talk to Gordon about it. I said, who's Gordon? He said, well, Gordon Quinn of Cartemquin Films. I knew nothing. My background was in Africa. I knew nothing about films. So the next day we met, and I approached Gordon, said, how would you like to do a documentary about community-based conservation in Africa? And his response was the same as David's.
What's that? Well,
what is
that? Let's go straight there.
And it's a wonderful new paradigm in conservation. It is taking place in Africa, of course, but other places too. I wouldn't want anybody to think that Africa is the only place this is happening. I'm focusing on Africa because that was my background and what I was familiar. But it's a new paradigm in conservation where communities are gaining benefit from the natural resources in their area, and the biodiversity is increasing and improving because of this relationship. It's a way of Homo sapiens to harmonize with their natural environment.
Now, historically, at least in the 20th century, there has been a kind of conflict between wildlife and human encroachment,
yes.
and conservation hasn't necessarily taken the needs of the community or the economics of the community into account.
Quite the opposite. The game parks in Africa are based on Yellowstone. And just as in Yellowstone, the Native Americans were forcibly removed in order to create Yellowstone and honor, in quotes, honor the natural environment and the landscape. In Africa, the same thing was done. People were forcibly removed in order to make game parks, but beyond landscapes, wildlife was what was going to be, in quotes, protected, without any regard to the fact that this was the homeland of these people, this is their burial grounds, this is where they had their livelihoods, their medicinal plants, and so on. And what Milking the Rhino does is take the camera that usually is in a nature film, looking at the animals, and turns it around to the back to what you don't see. And it's those people that have been forcibly removed and today are living with wildlife. So they sometimes, many times, are still in the periphery of the game parks. And elephants will come through and ruin their maize crop, and they have no recourse. Or lions and cheetah and leopards will come and take down their cattle, their donkeys, their goats. This is their livelihood. They may have a little garden plot, but this is their livelihood. And they, through the fences and fines, format of conservation that's taken place in the past got to the point where they didn't like wildlife. This was a detriment to them.
You see that in the film. People who don't want lions or who don't want other kinds of wildlife,
absolutely,
they want to kill them.
There's a whole scene in Namibia at a quarterly meeting that we filmed where that is being discussed. And one man gets up and he says, the cattle are my bank account. And if I lose cattle, that's my whole bank account. And he has a point. I mean, I dislike the fact that he was happy those lions were killed. But I understand his position. And it's the same position that ranchers will have around Yellowstone now with the reintroduced wolves.
Well, exactly. And even ranchers anywhere have about wolves, even here in New Mexico. I was thinking about exactly that analogy. How does community-based conservation actually address those people and their concerns and economic needs?
There are two approaches that we show in Milking the Rhino, and that doesn't mean those are the only two. But in Kenya, where we filmed the Ilnagwesi Maasai in northern Kenya, in the Laikipia area, north of Mount Kenya, the Maasai there, of course, are cattle people. They have been for centuries. This is their wealth. This is their identity. And through their association with Ian Craig, a neighbor who built Lewa Wildlife Conservancy, they slowly, very slowly, were convinced that, okay, we're going to try this conservation thing. And they built an eco lodge called Ilnagwesi. And they turned the area around Ilnagwesi, they took 80% of their grazing land for their cattle, their wealth, their identity, and put it aside for wildlife. And wildlife numbers are returning now. At one time, this area was heavily poached for elephant, for ivory. The wildlife are slowly coming back, and the lodge that they built, that they own, that they directly get benefit from, is increasing because the wildlife are increasing, tourists are increasing. So there's a direct correlation. Not everybody, even more than 12 years later, agrees within this community that this is the right thing to do.
Well, especially, I mean, if there's an international economic downturn in this, and these tourists stop showing up.
Yes, and we show that in the wedding scene in Milking the Rhino. This very discussion is taking place, and one man says, well, what if we have a drought of tourism? Just like when those buildings were bombed in the United States, we had a drought of tourism. Well, they just experienced that this last December through the elections and the controversy there. And they found that, yes, tourism did go down, and they need more of a economic base than just tourism. So they do depend on their cattle still. Even James, our main character at Ilnagwesi in Kenya, he will invest in cattle.
There is an interesting, many interesting things that come up culturally, which is, for example, if you are really cultivating tourism, then there are the cultural changes that happen to your own community when tourists show up. And one of them, for example, the man was saying, when he said, we Kenyans do not cook.
Yes.
We men do not cook. Yes. We do not cook for other people. We do not cook for women. This is against our ways.
Yes.
And you're just thinking, oh boy, and there they are serving menu items to, tourists.
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, tourism has always had that impact on any society where tourists have shown up. There's always a big footprint that's left and changes. And so that is a change. You see Kip and James in the office at Ilnagwesi, and they're working the books, and they're saying, but we don't take Visa or MasterCard or whatever it is. And James says, but we do take traveler's checks. You know, that in some circles is called capacity building. But that is part of the change, and development is part of community-based conservation. So the benefits from this example, Ilnagwesi in Kenya, the benefits to the community are roads, schools, clinics, road maintenance. James mentions that. What he didn't mention is the Ilnagwesi, like many Maasai in Kenya, live on what's known as group ranches. And these are big. They're neighborhoods within the group ranch. And in the Ilnagwesi example, each group ranch now has a radio phone. So if someone gets sick, they can call, where's the vehicle? The vehicle comes over, picks up the person, takes them to the clinic. That's a huge developmental benefit. But yes, it's changed. But as James says, throughout the film, our culture is our main purpose. We will not change it. And Maasai have always been very firm in that throughout colonialism and now.
Jeannie McGill is the, it's time to go, unfortunately, she is the originator and co-producer of the film Milking the Rhino, which screens in the Santa Fe Film Festival this Wednesday. It screens on Thursday, December 4th at 11:30, and then Saturday, December 6th at 7 o'clock at the DeVargas 3 Theater.
And there's going to be a reception after the 11:30 showing at the Chuck Jones Gallery.
Oh, excellent.
For a little auction.
Well, Jeannie McGill, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. We will see you tomorrow here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.